Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, and welcome to Past, the podcast about those who would never rule. I'm Veronica Fortune, and this week's episode is...
Charles of Valois, Part 3.
Welcome back. Last week, Charles of Valois was delayed in his attempt to claim a throne. Any throne. This week, we start with a bit of a scandal. Now I get to our first poisoning accusation. In early August 1308, Pope Clement ordered the Archbishop of Sens and the bishops of Orléans and Auxerre to investigate Bishop Guichard of Troyes. Guichard was accused of murdering Queen Joan, Philip the Fair's late wife and the Queen of Navarre in her own right, and her mother, the Dowager Queen of Navarre, Blanche, via sorcery, as well as trying to poison Charles of Valois and Louis, Philip the Fair's oldest son, the future Louis X. Guichard was tried throughout 1309 and eventually exiled. I do like that the first poisoning accusation I came to in my research of Charles is someone trying to poison him. Of note, a knight apparently drank the poison intended for Charles and Louis and died, so it might have been an actual attempt on his life. For more on this, I do recommend Courting Sanctity. It can be found in full on JSTOR, and it has a detailed rundown of this trial. In January of 1308, Philip needed Charles of Valois again, this time for a wedding. Charles of Valois and his younger brother, Louis of Evreux, were in Boulogne to celebrate the wedding of Isabella of France to Edward II of England. Remember, Isabella of France is the youngest child of Philip the Fair, making her Charles's niece. Both Charles and Louis then traveled to England for her coronation in February. You may remember that they were unimpressed with their niece's treatment. She was always going to be second best in Edward II's life, and that was rather clear from the start. I'm sure this will all end well for Edward, right? Not completely stymied in his attempts to conquer Constantinople, Charles began negotiating with the King of Serbia. This bit was rather fun to figure out in my translation of Petit's book. At the time, Serbia had two kings. One ruling actively, and one hanging around, still being king. They were brothers, so it's not too odd. It appears that it was the actual ruling one, the younger one, Stefan Uros II, who was negotiating with Charles. My translation had the name as Uros, so I had to double-check things. What also confused me is that they agreed that Stefan Uros II's second daughter, Nita, would marry Charles's second son, Charles. There are a lot of Charles in here. This marriage never happened and could have been planned to avoid giving Serbia a claim to Constantinople, since the younger Charles had no claim to the crown. He had a different mother than the mother the claim came through. And Charles of Valois was about to be distracted from his hopes of Constantinople by Germany. Albert of Austria, the King of Germany, was assassinated on the 1st of May 1308. Albert had been a claimant for the position of Holy Roman Emperor. Now, this bit is a little confusing. The last Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick II, had died in December 1250, which, doing basic maths, means it has been almost 58 years since there had been a Holy Roman Emperor. Frederick's son, Conrad, had attempted to become the emperor, but due to issues with the Pope at the time, he was never elected. Excommunication and death can do that. Another candidate didn't live long enough to be elected. There were two emperors elected in 1257 because no one had actually figured out the rules for who got to vote. I know, something they should have gotten on to. Neither is usually counted as an official emperor. Once the papacy and its bishops and the German princes had sorted themselves out, it was time for a proper election. Albert likely would have been elected and crowned by the Pope, but his assassination put a stop to that. His oldest son had predeceased him, and his younger sons didn't have the political or military pull to manage the election. So what does this election have to do with Charles of Valois? Well, Charles was actually a candidate for the Holy Roman Emperor. Yeah, so he's now tried being the King of Aragon, the Latin Emperor of Constantinople, and he's in the running to be the Holy Roman Emperor. In theory, he had a great hand. Remember, he got along well with Pope Clement. In addition, he had a few electors, in theory, in his pocket. The Archbishop of Cologne would support whoever Philip the Fair named unless the Pope told him not to. The Archbishop of Mentz would do what the Pope told him to do, and the Archbishop of Trier was a vassal of Philip the Fair. That gave him the three ecclesiastical electors in theory. Charles even went to visit Clement in Avignon to ask for help. He did take 6,000 men with him. It turns out that Clement was not comfortable with the French having this level of influence, as in being the King of France and one of them being the Holy Roman Emperor. So he secretly reached out to the ecclesiastical electors and told them to vote for someone who wasn't Charles, while telling Charles he was doing all that he could. Now, in Clement's defense, Charles probably would have lost Trier on his own. His original rival was a man named Rudolf, the Count of Palatine. But in the actual election, his rival was Henry of Luxembourg. The Archbishop of Trier was Henry of Luxembourg's brother. Trier, along with Clement, convinced the Archbishop of Cologne to support Henry of Luxembourg. In the end, every elector save the King of Bohemia supported Henry of Luxembourg, who became Henry VII. Philip the Fair was none too pleased. He did really like his brother, and he even asked Clement not to ratify the election. What's interesting, at least to me, is that Charles didn't take this loss poorly. He wasn't upset with Clement, and he helped the Pope get back on his brother's good side. Around this time, Charles was married for the third time at 38. His new bride was 15-year-old Mahout of Châtillon. They would have four children who all survived Charles: Marie, Isabella, Marguerite, who is also known as Blanche, and Louis. For those keeping track, that means Charles has three daughters named Isabelle or Isabella, though the oldest will die in 1309, two named Joan, two named Margaret. So yes, only one of his 10 daughters, Marie, has a unique name. I promise there were other female names available. I do just assume that each is named after their godmother and that some shared a godmother. This wouldn't have been completely uncommon. The papacy had been officially moved to Avignon in 1309. This put Clement out of control of the Italian cardinals, but under the watchful eye of Philip the Fair. Now, Philip and Clement really didn't get along well. Philip basically bullied Clement into suppressing the Templars, and he wasn't done yet. In 1309, Philip the Fair, well, everything short of forced Clement to posthumously put Boniface VIII on trial for heresy. Yes, Philip wanted the Pope he had strong-armed to death to be declared a heretic. You can imagine what a scandal this was. I guess the good news is that they didn't dig up Boniface's body. Oh yes, there's a story behind that. The Spanish kings were outraged and let Clement know. Clement tried to convince Philip to drop things by granting Philip's first minister, Nogaret, a pardon for the offense of kidnapping and beating Boniface. There were conditions attached. Nogaret had to do some penance, but at least he wasn't excommunicated any longer. Instead, Charles of Valois worked on the Pope's behalf, and by 1311, there was an agreement to end the trial. After some lovely play-acting, where knights threw down and offered trial by combat to prove Boniface's innocence,
Clement did have to disband the Templars officially in May 1312 at Philip's encouragement. The surviving Templars, those who hadn't been forgiving, including Jack de Molay, were executed in March 1314. I discuss this in The Capetian Miracle Ends, including de Molay's curse. I should remind you that Pope Clement V died on the 20th of April, 1314. After his death, there would be a two-year interregnum before John XII was elected, and this will be important soon. Charles of Valois benefited from the disbanding of the Templars. He received a not insignificant amount of funding from their treasury. Philip himself had his debts, at least to the Templars, wiped and got a pretty penny out of it. To emphasize, he was still in debt. France really struggled financially through this period, which probably would have been the biggest scandal of Charles and Philip's life, but fate had one more joke to play on them. Around the same time as de Molay's execution, Philip the Fair became aware that his daughters-in-law may be having affairs. His daughter, Isabella, clued him in on one of her many visits to France. This is the Tour de Nesle affair. I should note that Charles of Valois was the godfather of both his nephew, Charles La Marche, and Charles's wife, Blanche of Burgundy, who was accused in this affair. Charles sat in the tribunal that found against Blanche and Louis, the future Louis X's wife, Margaret. You may remember that Philip, the future Philip V's wife, Joan, was found guilty of not telling people what her sister Blanche and sister-in-law Margaret were up to. Both Blanche and Margaret were kept in prison. Margaret, until her death, possibly due to malnutrition and neglect or strangulation, and Blanche until Joan became queen consort. I will get there soon. For Charles, this time would lead to a sad goodbye. At the end of November 1314, his older brother, Philip the Fair, died at 46. Charles was 44, and I can imagine this made him face his own mortality a little. Philip appointed Charles one of his executors and gave him some funding for when he finally went on crusades. Philip also told his sons, especially Louis, his oldest, to take Charles's advice. Louis X did in fact do this, and it may explain his sobriquet, the quarrelsome. Pettit thinks that Charles was actually a good advisor, and I don't disagree with him. Let me explain. Louis the Quarrelsome, known as Louis X, pushed for a more centralized state. Now, we're not near the point of loyalty to the state versus just loyalty to the king or the count or the magistrate, but he really was giving it a bit of a try. The regional leadership, the leagues, were not happy about this. Philip the Fair had been trying to do something similar to help shore up French finances. Charles of Valois helped Louis with this, and while it wasn't a resounding success, it did make sense from a long-term political perspective, and most importantly, explains Louis X's sobriquet. He was quarrelsome because he was doing things his magnates didn't like. Louis needed a distraction for his leading men, and Charles helped him with one. Enguerrand de Marigny had been Philip the Fair's chamberlain, one of the men who was literally physically closest to the king. He opened the door for those who wished to visit the king. De Marigny was also a minister for Philip the Fair. This had made him rich, and his power had led him to offend a few powerful men, including Louis of Evreux and the Archbishop of Narbonne. And Philip the Fair, at the end of his life, hadn't protected him. De Marigny was indicted on normal criminal charges, abusing his power and such. It looked like he was going to be exiled due to having acted on the last king's behalf. But Charles of Valois had something waiting in his pocket. Well, or Margaret of Burgundy, Louis X's estranged wife, who was still in prison, sent him a letter. The Encyclopedia Britannica says Charles did it. Pettit says Margaret did it. The charges that were laid were that de Marigny helped his wife and sister with witchcraft against Louis X and Charles of Valois. De Marigny was found guilty and hanged. Oddly, his wife and sister were released. I'm sure the hanging scared everyone who had been beginning to rise against Louis X. Charles of Valois benefited financially from de Marigny's death. Shockingly, he was de Marigny's son, Louis's godfather. Over time, Charles actually worked to rehabilitate the family's name and properties. His son, Philip, the future Philip VI, continued this rehabilitation, and Louis XI, Charles's great-great-great-grandson, did as well. Charles of Valois had freed his own serfs in 1311, and he encouraged his nephew to do the same thing, which Louis X started doing in 1315. Now, Louis X is often given credit for freeing the serfs of France, and he kind of did, but he made them pay for it. He did this to raise funds, which is something the crown desperately needed. I don't want you to think that either of these men were humanists. Serfs who couldn't pay weren't free, and only serfs in royal domains were included. Serfdom wasn't completely abolished in France until 1789. One other thing I should quickly note is that Louis X reversed his father's
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Policy on Jews. He started allowing the return of some Jews to France. War with Flanders flared up in mid-1315. The Oriflamme, the flag advertising that no quarter would be given, was taken by Louis X from Saint-Denis on the 24th of June. The French troops were ready to move and began marching in September, only to be stopped by the weather. Extreme rain that year flooded roads and took out bridges. The land the troops tried to march through was bogged down and horses were getting stuck. The French were forced to retreat, and Louis X wouldn't get a chance to try again the next year. In June 1316, he died at 26. You should all remember that he left a pregnant wife and a 4-year-old daughter, whom he claimed from his scandalous first marriage. Charles of Valois had hoped he would be appointed regent, but Louis's younger brother, Philip, angled into the role. And after this message, you'll hear more. Philip was even asked to resign the regency to Charles by various magnates. Philip used his regency to maneuver his way into complete power. He was preparing for his sister-in-law to have a daughter. Something I didn't know when I did Joan II of Navarre's episode, her uncle agreed to support Philip at least as early as September of 1316, which is when Odo IV of Burgundy, Joan, the second of Navarre's uncle, who was 21, married Philip's daughter, Joan. Yes, there are a lot of Joans, who was 10. Yes, they had made a secret agreement well before the birth of the shortest serving French king to this point, John I. As you hopefully remember, John I only lasted 5 days as king. Both Philip and his mother-in-law, Mahout, were accused of poisoning by rumors at various courts.
Charles of Valois' godson, Charles, the youngest son of Philip the Fair, so this is Charles the March, actually accused, rightly, his brother of plotting to take the throne. Philip, of course, became Philip the Fifth, with the support of very little of the nobility, at least at first. Only 7 peers attended his coronation, including Charles of Valois and Mahout. Oddly, Louis of Evreux was there, but he wasn't actually Louis of Evreux yet. Yes, Philip V would elevate him. Sadly for Charles and Philip, as well as Louis, Louis of Evreux died in mid-May 1319. He was 43. His wife had died 8 years before him, but he was survived by 4 children, including Philip, who in 1318 had married Joan II of Navarre, who at the time was just Joan of France. Her uncle, Philip V, was the King of Navarre as well. Patrons will remember Joan and Philip's son, Charles the Bad. Charles of Valois became the guardian of both Louis of Evreux's sons, the aforementioned Philip, and Charles. And yes, that was a lot of Charleses in one paragraph. Charles of Valois was only peripherally involved with Philip V's rule. He did help to reconcile Philip V and the younger Charles le March in spring of 1317. John XXII, the Pope, congratulated Charles of Valois for reuniting the family in early June, and peace for the moment with Flanders was finally reached in January 1320. Charles of Valois, along with the other leading men of France, needed to swear not to follow Philip V if he were to attack Flanders. Philip V's daughter Margaret became a hostage married to her jailer as part of the peace when she was married to Louis of Flanders. She was approximately 10. Thankfully, her only son, also Louis, wouldn't be born for another 10 years. In good news for France, this means that the Count of Flanders wasn't against them. Not that this would stop almost everyone else in Flanders from being anti-French. But again, this isn't Flanders' episode. Charles of Valois was again offered funds to travel to the Holy Land, this time by Philip V. Everyone seemed to want Charles of Valois to go on crusade, but at the same time, everyone really needed him in France, Avignon, or Italy. In his defense, he had been born on a crusade, so I'm sure that counts for something, right? It looks like he was needed in France again in 1320 and into 1321. A shepherd's crusade had started in Normandy. Basically, the poor of Normandy wanted to convince Philip V to go on crusade. This group ended up being rather anti-Semitic as they made their way through France, and this is where Charles of Valois comes in. Pope John XXII condemned the shepherds, and Charles, along with Philip V, drove them out of France into Spain, where I assume they were totally helpful for the Spanish. Right? Outside of the Shepherd's Crusade, Charles wasn't deeply involved at the end of Philip V's reign. The last month of his nephew's rule saw a leprosy scare. Philip V died on the 3rd of January 1322. Since he had disinherited all women in his family and didn't have any sons, he was succeeded by his brother, Charles le March, as Charles IV. What I find interesting is that Philip V did have a son when he usurped the throne, his youngest child, also named Philip. Sadly, the younger Philip would die about a month after his father was crowned. I will emphasize that the younger Philip's parentage wasn't questioned. Philip V had gotten his wife out of imprisonment right away upon becoming king and was seemingly rather attached to her. The new king, Charles IV, also had a son at the time of his ascension, also a Philip. This Philip, though, probably wouldn't have been king due to his parentage. His mother was Blanche of Burgundy, who, as you'll remember, had been found guilty of adultery. The timing of the birth of their 2 children, Philip and Joan, was questionable. Joan had died the year before her father became king, and the younger Philip would die 2 months after. Charles IV needed an annulment, though, since his wife was still imprisoned, and, oddly enough, may have had an illegitimate child while there? Okay. Before I get to the annulment of Charles IV, I'll share the gossip about his imprisoned wife, Blanche, since it has a bit to do with Charles of Valois. So, I've only found this in Petit's book, and he references the unpublished historical documents from the 14th century, compiled by M. Boudet. In the show notes, I've copied the name in French if you want to look it up. So Petit claims that Thomas de la Marche, a French knight born between 1315 and 1318, was the son of Blanche, and possibly the son of Philip of Valois, Charles of Valois' oldest son, and the future Philip VI. Now, the online sources I could find, which are all open source or blogs, name Charles IV or Philip of Valois as Thomas's potential fathers, and don't name a mother. As I mentioned earlier, before becoming king, Charles IV was known as Charles La Marche. So, it could be his, or Philip's, or Blanche's child. I thought you would all enjoy a little bit of historical gossip. Okay, now back to the annulment for a Charles. Unlike his brother, Charles IV didn't starve his wife to death or have her strangled. Instead, he was able to secure an annulment. He had two grounds that didn't include adultery. Charles of Valois took control of the annulment proceedings and communicated with the Pope on his nephew's behalf. He testified to the Pope that his nephew, who was his godson, and Blanche, who was his goddaughter, were both too young at the time of their marriage, 12 for girls and 14 for boys, to consent to being married. In addition, the mother of Blanche, Mahout, was the godmother of Charles IV, which brings the problem of consanguinity. Remember, there are some interesting rules when it came to godparents. John XXII granted the annulment on the 19th of May, 1322, and Blanche was moved to a convent for the remainder of her life. Her date of death isn't recorded, but she likely predeceased her former husband. With his nephew's marriage annulled and a new queen found, Charles of Valois was looking to go on crusades. It really was something he kept trying to do. While he was still in France, though, he sat on his nephew's council meetings and was active in his reign. Charles IV decided that he wanted to go on this crusade, and plans were made to try to reunite the Latin and Greek churches and lead a combined group to the Holy Land. John XXII even agreed to the plans and congratulated Charles of Valois for his zeal. He was even given a tenth from both France and Navarre in preparations for this crusade. Due to his strong influence over his nephew, he was basically the key to the king's door throughout Charles IV's early reign. Their plans for a crusade, though, were stopped by an old problem. England. You thought I was going to say Flanders, didn't you? Many of you know what's coming next, mainly because I covered a lot of this in Isabella of France's episodes. Edward II of England had refused to leave England to swear homage to Charles IV. He had sworn it to Louis X, but since then, things in England had become messy. Charles of Valois' military skill was needed because a lack of homage meant that the property attached to said homage was forfeit. Charles of Valois and his son-in-law, Robert of Artois, were sent to Gascony to retake the territory. Edward II's half-brother, Edmund of Woodstock, who, by the way, is Charles of Valois' nephew, was leading the English forces in Gascony. Charles and Robert first attacked La Réole. This attack was driven back effectively, and the Marshal of France died. I'm starting to feel like this is just an unsafe job. Instead, Charles and Robert blockaded the city. Getting hungry makes men give up a little when stuck in a castle. So Edmund of Woodstock did surrender and signed a truce on the 22nd of September, 1324. He was allowed to retreat to Bordeaux. Edward II folded on the 28th of December. As part of their treaty negotiations, Louis of Valois, Charles's third surviving son and youngest child, was betrothed to Joan of the Tower, Edward II of England, and Isabella of France's youngest child. This wedding never happened. Joan eventually married David II of Scotland as a hostage married to her jailer, and Louis died in November of 1328 at about 10 years old. And this is actually where Charles's story ends. He saw his niece for a time during her visit to France to negotiate the peace between England and France. It's unlikely that he saw his great-nephew Edward, the future Edward III of England, when he came to pay homage to Charles IV. Edward arrived in September of 1325, and Charles of Valois had been either partially paralyzed by illness or bedridden with gout by August of 1325. He was rather unwell at the end of his life. He had written his will that he be buried between his first two wives, as in his grave be situated between theirs, and he had been given papal permission to have his heart buried with his third wife. I guess she couldn't cuddle with the three of them in death? He died on the 16th of December, 1325, at the age of 55. His funeral was attended by the king, Charles IV, Charles of Valois' own sons, and his daughter, Isabella, the Countess of Hainaut. As you should know, since you're listening to past, Charles never ruled France. His son Philip, though, would become Philip VI on the 1st of February, 1328, when Charles IV died at either 33 or 34. This actually made Charles IV the longest lived of Philip the Fair's sons. It actually means that Charles of Valois only needed to live 2 years, 1 month, and 16 days to be the King of France. Remember, our first subject, Charles of Orléans, needed to live 33 more years, at which point he would have been 103. Our second, Charles of Angoulême, needed to live 19 more years, when he would have been in his late 50s. Antoine de Bourbon needed to live 27 more years, at which point he would have been 71. Charles of Valois really was the only one of the fathers in the series that really could have been king, and he seemed to want it more than anyone else. Well, or just to be king of anything. Before I get to my final thoughts, I want to discuss Le Roi Maudit, The Accursed Kings. It's probably one of the most influential fictional accounts of France and the French court during the period that Charles of Valois lived. It is a six-part novel published between 1955 and 1977. Now, I haven't read the series yet, but it apparently does not present Charles of Valois in a flattering light. As I think you can see from his episode, he was a nuanced man, like all of us. He did, though, cause the downfall of at least one of his brother's leading men, and he went along with the disinheriting of his great-niece. At the same time, though, he was a moderately successful military leader and a trusted advisor to his nephews. So, would Charles of Valois have been a better king than the king, or in his case, kings, who ruled instead of him? Well, it depends on which rule we're looking at. Let us assume that Philip IV never had any children. Then I think Charles of Valois would have been a great choice for king. He lived 11 years after his brother's death and would have been a stabilizing influence compared to three kings in what turned out to be 13 years. But let's say history is what it is, and Philip the Fair's three sons lived. I think Charles of Valois probably would have been a better king than Louis X. Politically, they were aligned, but I think Charles, being an older man who had shown military strength and skill, would have stopped the internal dissent that Louis X dealt with. I think Philip V was a usually good king, and Charles probably couldn't have done better than him. With Charles IV, I think it wouldn't have made much of a difference either way. Both of these Charleses seemed to work well together. Now finally, as compared to his son, Philip VI, I think Charles of Valois' reign wouldn't have been much different for France in general. I think Edward III of England would still have tried to claim the French throne. There is a chance that Charles of Valois' military experience may have convinced Edward to wait a little while longer. But I think Edward III really wanted to be the king of two kingdoms. I'm really glad I've done these episodes about Charles. I didn't expect to find him this interesting. I thought he'd just feel like a schemer, but he really did seem like a nuanced human being. I don't agree with the assessment on his Wikipedia that he agreed with his nephew, Philip V, to usurp Joan II of Navarre to make his path to the throne easier. And yes, I do always read each subject's Wikipedia while I'm researching, because it's good to see what others are saying about these subjects and what will come up in pop history. I think he knew the political situation of France and realized that a four-year-old girl who was an orphan could not handle the situation. And I don't think he's wrong. I think a four-year-old without a surviving parent would have been in a bad position, regardless of their sex. Louis X had left things a little messy, having struggled with his magnates, and then, right before he died, failing at an invasion of Flanders. I think it's important to note that each country gets to decide how they choose their leadership, and France choosing to exclude women is something we should question today. But at the time, it made sense. With that, I'll be back in 2 weeks to start discussing the sons of Suleiman the Magnificent. Patrons, you will have a special episode about Catherine de Medici coming up on Wednesday, and a special episode about William Adelin the following Wednesday. I also apparently forgot to release a This Too Should Pass on wardships, so I'll be releasing that tomorrow, and I will see you all very soon. Thank you, as always. Thank you for listening to Past. I can be found on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at PastPod. That's PassedPod. Please feel free to email me at PastPod@gmail.com. I have a Patreon that can be found at patreon.com/PastPod.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us.
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.